Welcome to the Sketchy Podcast. My number is 14.
And I'm Mr. B.
Today on the show, we're going to be talking about Remembrance Day, Armistice Day,
Veterans Day, whatever. Comparing it to Memorial Day, Anzac Day.
Whatever you want to call it. We're going to be talking also about my review for Battlefield 1, which is kind of related to Remembrance Day. But before we start, what are you drinking? What are you drinking?
Well, today we just had a...
Kind of topical, yeah.
I did have an accident, but not that kind.
Little spillage.
Not that kind. I'm not at that stage of life yet. Soon. Even though we're Canadians, we are obsessed with the
craft brew industry.
We're obsessed with the circus of American politics, and we had a little party at the compound. And this is some leftover beer from election night party. I think we had leftover beer because the mood got very depressed towards the end of the evening.
Yeah. Very.
Everyone was like, I'm just going to go. I have to go cry.
See, this is why I wish I was almost a conservative, because they probably had a fucking blast that night, man.
So I'm drinking.
Hell of a blast.
Some microbrew from the area here called Alchemist. I have two going right now. An India Pale Ale and a Scottish beer of some kind.
Yeah, you know what I like about it? I like how it's, how do I say that? It's pretentious in a cheap way.
Right.
I don't know how
cheap else to tentious.
Describe it. Yeah, cheap tentious. Yeah. It's basically like saying like, ooh, we're so cool for making craft brew. And I've always thought, your beer's too strong. Too many notes.
It's like a snob slumming it.
I don't know. Anyways. Yeah. You know that I've always liked my beer to be inoffensive, and that's what I drink. Inoffensive beer. And again, I'm back to the old Pabst Blue, baby.
Okay, I think something's up. You and Donald Trump have some connection to Russia that you just don't want to admit.
I know, right? But I'm hopeful that my connection to Russia is going to lead to peace and not some form of... dissolution of other alliances.
Have you heard Russia's on the line saying they would like to restore peace with our podcast?
Yes, they want to restore peace and give us money. Give us lots of that. Give us rubles.
We'll have rubles for days.
Yay! But anyways, I drink it for the same reason I always drink it. It is the cheapest beer I can afford. And it is the least offensive, because actually there is one or two beer brands that are slightly cheaper. And by that, I mean like 10, 20 cents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not... Who gives a shit at that point? I mean, you might as well be choosy, I guess.
So even though you're going for the cheapest beer possible, you're still not willing to give up your Mother Russia beer. Even though there's one made locally, and it has the name of our city
It hires Americans, though. It's just the profits go to Russia. So, you know, you got to be divided about that.
Right. Suspicious. The whole thing is suspicious.
Whatever. But anyways, like I said, if it was free and as if the beer was inoffensive, I would drink that. But we are not yet at that stage, ladies and gentlemen. We have no sponsor. As of now, while, you know, the news has not gone out about the podcast, I think we get an average listen of about 25 right now, which is about 20 of those probably me. So I do appreciate you new listeners out there. Trust me.
Thanks, you five weirdos.
You fucking weirdos. But you're the lucky ones, because you really get to tell people that you listened to it when it was that small again. I mean, this is now
the third time
I go and I just start anew and be like, all right, let's just start this podcasting shit. I remember what it's like to talk to like three people that you're podcasting for, but you're like, hey, I like these three people, so they're all right.
Would you say you're an internet tastemaker?
No, I wouldn't say that either. I would say that the only gift I truly possess, it seems, and I can no longer deny it, is that I can talk you to death. That's what I can do. I can talk a human being to death. You put
me
in front of
superpower.
This fucking microphone, and I can do hours upon hours of that shit. We even did that telethon, man, just to prove that I could do it.
Wow, I'm still recovering. That was years ago.
What year was that, actually? 2013?
2013, I believe. Yeah. Had live music. We had...
This was before everybody was doing their old live stuff. I don't think that I'm a tastemaker. What I think is that I'm always... This at least I will admit myself of this. I'm always about 4 or 5 years ahead on any internet trend. You know, I was ahead on freemium. I was ahead on social networks. I was ahead on podcasting. The only thing I was behind on is YouTube, because here's the truth. When I was working on my shit back in the old days, I was like, I want to own everything I make. I don't want to split it up with some kind of fucking arrangement that in order to make money, suddenly I can't really own that shit. And whoever I'm working with could kill my crap without really, you know, ever needing to ever give it back. Which is not cool, by the way.
Yeah. But ultimately, you sort of have to go where people are looking for stuff anyway.
Yeah, well,
right?
And I don't need to stay there forever, because YouTube's not going to last forever.
Well, in terms of like the sellout scale, probably being on YouTube is a lot less painful than publishing a book on Amazon,
yes,
for example.
Very
right?
Much
you give up less,
yep.
You gain more. Well, I suppose the potential gains are higher on Amazon, but it's a different game.
It's
totally different
game. The gains are higher, but you know, one of these days I'm going to do one of those podcasts that I've promised to do, which is about the history of copyright, which really is at the crux of my dilemma when trying to publish things online. But I will summarize it thusly. The fact that when you get anything off Amazon or Apple or anything else like that, you don't actually own it. You're renting it. It's in your agreement. So if those companies ever go down, guess what happens to your shit? Gone. It was never yours to begin with.
Or the cloud version that allows you to download it again or something like that.
No, I'm referring, even if you download again, you're renting it. Look, the ownership of that, what that is, the reason why you cannot sell it is because you don't fucking own it, bro.
You get a complicated license that grants you the permission to put it on like a limited number of your devices. It's all very
weird.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive. Like a time traveler wouldn't understand it. They'd be like, I bought that scroll, I bought that book, and I own it, right?
I feel sorry for the anthropologists of the future, really.
But in return, we've gained portability. Like, so many trade-offs, even quality trade-offs, have been made in the name of being able to download things everywhere, stream things everywhere. And you know what? It's hard to argue that in a pinch, you know, you want to play that song at a friend's house at a party, for example, or download that book on that new tablet you bought. You're willing to give up a lot. You know, the whole vinyl debate is sort of along the same lines. The digital formats that came, you know, mini disc, CD, you could argue that MP3 is not an improvement of quality.
It's really not.
It's a super lossy, right?
Well, it was a compromise we had to make. Remember when we were downloading MP3s on fucking dial-up, yo?
Mm.
Those nightmarish days. Okay, children, because that's who's on fucking YouTube. Listen up, children. You will understand a history lesson in pain. Once upon a time when there was a program called Napster, and when most people were on goddamn dial-up.
Pre-Napster. I'm going to go back a little bit, before Napster.
Before that.
There was a time when wherever you were downloading a song from, it could be some sketchy FTP site.
That's the only way you were downloading. You were downloading literally from other
people's
computers.
Some website that would change every day or whatever.
Well, of course it would.
You'd have a program called Winamp. I don't know if Winamp's still around. I'd be curious to check it out.
I'm sure it is.
And you would basically be downloading this file, and Winamp would keep looping. And so the time it would take for the song to play 10 seconds, you would download a little bit more, and the next loop around, you'd make it to 12, then to 14, then to 18. And it was just, the suspense was crazy.
To be fair,
downloading
though,
a song took hours.
To be fair, though, if you have the first verse of a song, I mean, you basically have the song.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's like one of those grandfatherly stories of the good old days, or we appreciated things more when we were around the fire telling stories. And in a way, it was true. Like, the excitement of getting just one song was so great. Whereas now, like, oh, I'll download the entire discography. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay,
well,
I got
the whole
discography, and I'm never going
to
listen.
So if you were talking to your grandpa and you were trying to get a similar response, hey, grandpa, what used to drive you crazy? I think their answer would be
Wolves.
What was their internet at the time, which is basically telegraph. And sending and receiving messages, which was basically the equivalent of Twitter, if you want. You didn't have a character limit, but you did when you have to pay for every fucking dot.
Well,
you know,
yeah, I would say like the fun times were had on the radio and the black and white television. But yeah, I guess Twitter, I think people Twitter don't understand. Has something in common
people
with
don't
Telegraph.
Really understand this. The size, by the way, of Telegraph. Like, it was its own fucking internet. It had a huge backbone. It ran across the ocean.
There
too,
were
bitches.
Several. Look up old maps. Maybe yeah. We'll post one in,
we should.
In notes.
Yeah, we should.
There are old maps of these insanely long lines that would run across the Atlantic. I think there were some out to some of the Pacific Islands. I don't think it went all the way. Maybe Guam or Hawaii or something. But just amazing. Yeah. Just incredible.
Well, they did post up, by the way, during World War.
During electrical telegraph storms, lines, so. Those lines would heat up and shock people. It really wasn't that great. It was not that great.
Yeah, imagine your internet now giving you a fucking electrical shock. Talk about bullying.
Bzz.
Yeah.
Trigger.
So, let's talk about our first subject now that we're off on multiple tangents. Let us talk about Remembrance Day. So for those of you who
that's
did
a Canadian
not...
version of
fine.
Veterans Day, which is different from Memorial Day. So Veterans Day celebrates people who have fought, generally honoring people who are alive, I suppose. Memorial Day honors the dead. Whereas Canada has Remembrance Day, and it's sort of primarily honoring the fallen soldier, but also we honor people.
No, but it's
still
it's on November 11th for a fucking real
yes,
simple
yes,
reason.
Yes, exactly.
Which is why I think it's the most sensical time to have this damn holiday, because when World War I ended, although I would argue that it was just a armistice that lasted, you know, a few decades. All the effect was is it allowed people to rearm themselves more. But when that was signed, it was signed specifically because they thought, well, we need people to remember this date, right? So when they signed it, they decided that it was going to be at November 11th at the 11th hour, right? But here's the thing about it. Now, this was... There were many months where...
And
where
the
this
11th
peace
minute.
Process, yeah,
the 11th minute.
Where this peace process was happening. And when they signed that, many people knew that there was peace that was coming, but they were forced to fucking fight to the last breath, even though they knew that peace was coming, until the very fucking second. And there are thousands of people that died for this kind of useless shit so that you could remember. So when you're that poppy, really what you're remembering, part of it is not just the war, it's also the crazy tragedy of how we try to even memorize our brutality. Like, we can't even get good at peace signing. You know what I mean? We fuck that up. We try to make it epic. Let's make sure it's on 11-11-11-11. Well, there's going to be 10,000 fucking soldiers that are going to die because of that shit, idiot.
Signed between 5:12 and 5:20 in the morning. So that leaves a few hours of nasty.
Yeah. So.
Interesting. Yeah. Curious.
And
the things
also
we do for symbols.
And the peace process was delayed. A lot of people don't know this, but there was... Okay, so... I guess what we'll do is we'll start talking at the very beginning about World War I, right? Because, which is interesting because World War I is an example of certain empires who are starting to flex their muscle. And that empire is Germany. Now, before Germany was Germany, it was kind of lots of disparate states. And the most important and powerful of those was Prussia, okay? And Prussia and France, let's just say that they have had their fucking issues, okay? Before the First World War, there was something called the Franco-Prussian War. And when Germany united under one country, it realized something very important. It had a larger population than France. So it could kind of start flexing its muscle. And what was happening, too, at the same time is that you have all these empires that are forming these kind of alliances together, right? The way they figure is the equivalent of their mutually assured destruction. If major powers ally together, there will be a balance of power, and then no one will dare attack each other, which is, you know, the mutually assured destruction strategy that doesn't seem to really work in the long term, because there's always somebody that's going to say, you know what? I think I can win. And that was definitely Germany, okay? Now, you could say that the reasons for the war were like, oh, the Archduke was murdered. Well, for 2 months, no one gave a shit. No one cared, okay? it wasn't a big deal. It was just a really good excuse for two parties to go to war for one, with one another and for everybody else to be dragged into it. But generally speaking, Germany decided to punch everyone in the fucking face because it's like, you know what? We're sick and tired of being the third-ranked superpower here because we think we can be number one. We think we can be top dog. And they had a pretty good strategy. They're like, you know what? France is, if we take Paris through Belgium, we're going to beat the shit out of them. We're going to roll right through. And so they do this. And they'd have huge success. And Germany is fucking kicking so much ass. They have better weapons. Their soldiers are more trained. And they have a purpose. Like, when you're defending army, it's hard. Like, you're defending, man. Like, if you were in a fight, and you're the guy defending the element attacking, you'll surprise. Be twice as exhausted.
Exactly. So do you think there was anyone in France who saw it coming, or was it just so fast and so insane that they were constantly on the defense and never managed to get
it? You know, I can't comment about the political state of the people in France at that time because I would say that my research isn't good enough to tell you that. But I think that what it comes from again is sort of Germany's feeling that it didn't get a lot of respect.
Right. So they had that purpose. They had a universal drive.
Yeah. Yeah, they had a universal
drive. To get it done, and they had their tools at the time, so they did it.
And now you probably think at the time, like, ooh, those Germans must have been, like, probably anti-Semitic at the time. But if you would have actually tried to analyze the situation, you would have guessed that France was much more likely to be the country that would have had, like, huge anti-Semitic violence. I mean, before the First World War, there was something called the Dreyfus Affair, where a Jewish soldier was basically given a kangaroo trial, it kind of set up as a patsy, and the half the country was divided about that shit. So there are even political cartoons being like, in polite society, one does not talk about the Dreyfus Affair. And then the next one, all of his family members are beating the shit out of each other and says, ooh, they talked about the Dreyfus Affair. You know, so France had its issues. Like, okay. But France and Britain had huge colonies and global power, while Germany was still kind of struggling, right? Like,
right.
It had, I think, well, it only
sort
had
of the
one
history
in East Africa.
Germany never got to
colonize.
Have that naval influence on the world. And maybe it affected the psyche of the people.
I definitely think it did. So, I mean, this is what led to their idea. And I think you also have to understand that before the First World War, war was still a kind of fight that had certain rules. Like, for instance, armies would meet themselves in would meet at certain battlefields, and there were certain conditions. And, like, you could almost, like,
there was a coin flip.
You could sit down and watch this shit. I mean, there used to be audiences that went to go watch these wars.
Right.
Like, the Napoleonic Wars had an audience, bro. Okay? They didn't shoot at the civilians. By then, they were like, they thought that was unthinkable. They figured themselves as sort of like these genuinely heroic figures that were going out, proving their mettle, and coming back heroes. This was the general view of things. You went to war to become a man, and you came back battle-hardened and, like, ready to fight. But in most of the wars that were fought in the old days, I mean, your chance of dying weren't always that great. The weapons were crappy, you know. But the First World War is where you start having machine guns and tanks and
death is real and the world
bombs.
Is horrible.
Yeah. And one of the things that you probably don't know is when you're looking at the weapons of the First World War and the Second World War, you don't see a lot of difference. You just see an evolution of all of the lessons that have been learned from that first one. So, you know, anyways, let's go back to sort of like the beginnings of it. So, yes, Germany decides that it's going to start a motherfucking fight, and they're really good at it so far, but they're eventually, and this is what basically leads to the worst of the war, everybody sort of figures out that, okay, well, now we're going to dig ourselves in, and this is where trench warfare becomes the thing that you sort of read about in stories in high school, but you don't really fucking remember reading. I mean, you just hear about it, but I don't think you can really fathom it. The people were talking about this war like, after 6 months, they didn't even remember that there was normal life anymore. They thought that all there was fear and death, and that the whole world had gone crazy, and that basically we were just about to annihilate ourselves. And that's what we were doing, you know, at the tunes of millions of fucking people. So when the war starts, like, it gets messy really fast. So the hope is the colonial powers figured out that if they start to involve other countries, they might tie up the resources of their enemies and weaken the fronts that they're trying to conquer. So this is where we start seeing all of these other countries that get involved in these wars. And they're getting involved in ways like that are strange. Like a good example is the Americans had black men that enlisted and went to war, but the Americans refused to actually command them. So they were being commanded by the French.
Say what?
And the French fucking loved black people, especially them. Like they didn't like all black people. They liked sophisticated, cool cats of America.
Okay.
So, you know, these were guys that were
Jazzy folk.
Yeah, well, you have to remember actually that most of the blacks that had enlisted and were musicians, part of their traditions were of being Creole black. I don't know if you know what that is, but before the Emancipation Proclamation, you could be a black man and own slaves in America. You just had to have been educated in Europe and have a certificate that said that you were an educated black Creole and you had the rights of a white man necessarily as much, but you could own land and slaves and you were a first class citizen.
A foreign businessman.
Racism had its... It was more complicated than you could possibly imagine. So when the Emancipation Proclamation happened, those Creole blacks became just like the other blacks. And now these classically educated men were suddenly a slave class and, you know, now no longer protected, didn't have any rights, witness to Jim Crow laws. So these guys go over to Europe and they are treated like fucking gods because... You know, and the Americans are terrified by this. They send letters to the French army saying, you are not allowed to treat them like normal. You will undermine our society. And we are totally justified in what we're doing. Whether or not the French army listened is probably up in the air.
It seems like they had bigger battles to win. Yeah. But
if you ever actually wonder where the French love of jazz came from, it really was the First World War and the introduction of these French black soldiers that lived among French people and taught them like all this music. This is why France is probably like the musical powerhouse it is today, really, because of jazz coming from America. And you have to remember at the time, like after the First World War II, jazz, when it really started to take off, was more exciting to people than, you know, the height of classical music. Like this, people were fucking losing their shit. But anyways, let's go back to the First World War, okay? So
that was a jazzy tangent.
So anyways, everybody, yeah, sorry about that, folks. So anyways, we're at a stage where now you have this, all these people of different countries are coming. You have the British Raj, which is bringing in like hundreds of thousands of Indian soldiers and sending them to Africa to fight German mercenary soldiers who are black. So you have these proxy wars where everybody's involved and they're not even sure why they're fighting, but they have to. They have no other fucking choice. And many of them wonder, like, am I going to become a slave, like, after this is done? Like, they have no idea what the fuck is going on. And many of them are just being put in the front lines as motherfucking cannon fodder. So, yeah, like the world war that we normally think, I think when we think World War I, is we normally think the trench warfare in Europe, but we forget the whole world was involved in this. And it was, and some of the humanitarian fucking things that were just like an ancillary of this. So in Africa, in East Africa, the entire army of the Brits was constantly on retreat for 4 years. They traveled the distance of 2 Frances, okay? Moving every fucking day. They were a size of about 3,000 being chased by an army of 10,000. And they just, it was the most mobile war in human history. And in order to do this, the Brits hired 1 million African men to use as fucking pack mules, packing them with 60 pounds of weights and no shoes. Your odds of surviving...
We sure are good at dehumanizing our brother, aren't we?
Your odds of surviving were 1 in 6. The same as if you were a soldier in the fucking war.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just exhaustion and breaking them ankles or whatever.
And just like, well, they would drive them like motherfucking dogs, man. You think that just because they were paid, that they treated them good? Yeah, I don't think so.
My God.
And if you understand that in Africa at the time, like, the world wars were kind of isolated in the trench warfare. The soldiers themselves experienced most of the horrors, but not the population. But in Africa, because of the mobility of the war, every village was witness to fucking constant fighting, massacres, and death. Now, these villages don't have written traditions. They only have oral traditions. But what has survived and what we've gathered from anthropologists is that when they talk about this period, it is in biblical proportions. They refer to it as the darkness. Okay? 100 years ago, darkness descended upon our land. The pale faces came with their machines and monsters, you know, and killed us all. Yeah. Terrifying. I mean, imagine that you just for, I don't know, 30,000 years, you had the same way of life, and all of a sudden, some ghost-faced motherfucker in a metal monster puts a gun in your hand, forces you to fight, shoot your own fellow fucking villagers, or hear their cries of death as you retreat because you're not allowed to stay and fucking fight for your home.
Well, that's horrid.
Happy Veterans Day, everybody. The more you understand about World War One and its conflicts, the more you just kind of like, oh man, it's kind of sick. It makes me sick.
Society.
I want to talk about the experience of some of those black soldiers again. Let's go back to that. Because we're going to switch around a lot. Because their experiences in the war must have been something that they would really never forget. Because you have to remember that most of them had been living again in poverty, not allowed to own any land, or constantly terrorized by the Ku Klux Klan and so on and so forth, lynchings. I mean, at some years, there were as many as 4,000 lynchings a year in the United States. I mean, this is a massacre.
That's a lot.
It's a fucking massacre.
That's a bit much.
Anyways, so you go to war, and you're in France, and you're in Europe, which has specifically France at that time, had a different attitude about black people. I'm not saying again that France was the most open people, because they had a problem with the people's religion, Jewishness, I guess. But again, it's more complicated than just, oh, they're racist.
Yeah, it's strange. Would you call that some form of intersectionality? Is that the right word?
No,
class
right
and
term.
Race intersecting in a matrix of madness?
I think it's more that...
Am I using that term?
Yeah, right? Definitely wrong. You're okay. Using it entirely wrong, and okay. Never use that word with me anymore. It's one of the most asinine words in the dictionary. But...
Anyway,
we'll talk about that. It was the relationships were always complex, and it's not as though you can describe a country's feelings. There are people who make up a country. Their individual feelings is what matters. You know, the same way that temperature isn't the average of, it is the average of like all of these fast moving particles, but it doesn't mean that some are moving wicked fast and some are moving crazy slow, you know?
That's a rather analytical analogy for such a sloppy idea.
Sloppy idea.
Usually it's the other way around. Analogies are sort of vague.
I see.
You know what I mean?
Whatever. I mean, it's not good. Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying it's amorphous. It's not a criticism. But it's rare that whatever. The analogy is
more
precise.
Complicated than
more precise than the
what you're trying
to describe. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but what I'm trying to describe is nebulous. It's racism
I know,
and prejudice.
I know,
you
I know,
cannot
I know.
Be precise about that. That's the problem. But anyway, so these black soldiers... I mean, some of these guys get medals and serious medals. I mean, there were these guys called...
The best medals. Tremendous medals.
The Harlem Hellfighters, which were known for having never conceded any fucking territory. Or, like, these were some of the most badass fighters. So imagine that you are given all these medals. You are fucking decorated. And one, your country not only does not want to recognize you, but there were many of those soldiers that when they returned home... They were murdered and lynched for wearing those uniforms. So you went to war, you fought for your country, and then you went back home and were murdered, lynched, because you refused to take off your fucking uniform and the medals that you had
righteously
earned.
Talk about a population
I mean, like,
that wasn't
you
ready
make,
for the next stage.
I mean, you want to make a fucking movie that would outrage people? Just talk about the
story. The lynched soldier.
Yeah, the lynched fucking soldier who was a god in Europe
who
and
was
in the
a
war.
Hip jazz man in France and a hero at war.
A fucking worldly man who had seen hell and survived it.
Right.
And you go home and some fucking redneck piece of shit hangs you from a
draft
tree.
Dodger hangs you from a tree.
Yeah. Guy who had never fucking dared
to
venture out of his home. If you want to be outraged, happy remembrance to everybody.
The depravity of mankind.
But my shows are so dour, right? These historical, like, Jacob, stop being so historical.
Yeah, well, you know,
being dour.
Do you think it's even possible that we will eventually get away from fighting our own battles? You know, we have this idea of proxy wars or mercenaries and soldier for hire, but, you know, robots fighting instead of humans and maybe eventually moving towards other displays of force, maybe having
let me unwrap
supercomputers fight each other.
You're asking like 8 questions, so let me unwrap one of them, Mr. Ask Too Many Questions. I'll tell you about the future of war because I think that you have a good point. Because the World War I was really how wars evolved from there. You have to understand that the modern warfare was really defined by the First World War, because not only the weaponry, but deployment, the structure and size of battalions, all of these things are determined from the experiences of the First World War. So it's really, everything is just kind of like a factor of that. And one of the things of the war is that it became such a machine that the only thing that limited its ability to continue was manpower, right? If you could have an unlimited amount of men, there would have been no reason for the war to end. You know, if you didn't have this kind of inherent part of yourself that couldn't kill, like there is literally a kill threshold. This is something the Nazis learned. They learned that one of the reasons they did the gas chambers is at first they were just shooting people. And then after people had shot about 100 people in cold blood,
they just couldn't do it anymore.
They could not fucking do it and they broke down.
Huh.
So they were like, we've got to eliminate the personable element of murder. We need to soften it for the people who are committing the murder. So, you know, these are important lessons that you learn from war. Well, gee, well, to kill more people, it's got to be like press a button and then they're dead.
Well, the ultimate is the nuclear launch from the comfort of the Oval Office, for example.
Yeah, but you know
or
what?
Or from some other.
But the problem with that is that, you know, the powerful fallout and. I mean, we're talking about the best way to do it would be really, again, like just you press a button and someone falls asleep and they die. Like, it's just, that's why even modern executions is what they try to make it do. Like, oh, you stop moving and you stop breathing, you're dead. So humane.
Yeah, there are sort of odd traditions around like firing squads where, you know, you'll have
one guy has the real bullet and the rest
always more than one person, right? Yeah. That's why it's a squad. And therefore, they can all sleep comfortably at night knowing that they might not have been the person who actually killed the guy.
Exactly.
And they can miss, or, you know.
So the thing about AI is it doesn't need to be programmed with any of these things. And so long as the human labor can produce an infinite amount of these robots, then the world of the future could see an endless war. So long as you're able to supply the most important element of it, which is the foot soldier. And it doesn't necessarily need to be human.
So get this. So maybe in the future, China and America will enter a war of AIs. But instead of simply attacking the other AI, they're competing to like fold cancer curing proteins faster than the other side.
Oh, man.
Wouldn't that be like, we're pivoting war.
Your hopefulness is sickening.
We're
going to
disrupt war.
It's sickening. Yes. That's what it is.
It's not going to happen.
No, definitely not. Because you can't militarize that.
Although you could argue that large-scale sort of countries battling other countries, maybe the days of that are sort of waning because now the wars are sort of fought at the international corporate level. Corporations taking over countries, essentially, and their resources and mergers and acquisitions. Like, the real locus of power is the corporation.
Stop trying to bring it into today. What is your obsession with today? Fuck today, man.
You're right. I just live here.
Stop fucking thinking about today, because you know what? You think today is so fucking important, but it is meaningless. Just like tomorrow's meaningless. Okay?
Let me use an analogy. It's like a scanning electron microscope, okay?
First, it blasts the area with. Okay, so What I wanted to kind of refer back to, so because I don't want to quite finish about World War One because I have a few more things to say.
Get
about
on
it.
With it.
This is Veterans Day, buddy. So if you really want to know your World War One histories, there's a few more things you got to learn, and this is probably the, I don't want to say if it's a saving grace of it, but there was one thing that was very different about that war too, is that the involvement of so many other ethnic groups into the war is. And their requirement to kill white people was actually the first time that was ever allowed. Because remember back then in Empire, if you were not a white person, you weren't allowed to murder another white person. Okay, that could not fucking happen. You were just in a lot of trouble. And there's a certain mystique that was built up around that, right? Like a kind of almost a prestige. So as soon as they're like, you know what? Forget all about that. You can shoot him. I mean, if you want to think about the real way in which these countries saw their independence, I think going to war and shooting a bunch of white people and seeing them bleed and seeing that they bleed just like anybody else probably taught the guys who came back a lot of lessons about, you know, all of this stupid bullshit that they were kind of brainwashed into. So, you know, this is why in Australia, I mean, World War One was really important for Australia. They still celebrate like a very important day in history, like not remembering like the dead, but really kind of marking themselves as, you know, as saying, we're not just a motherfucking colony. You can't just send us over to die for you for no fucking reason. You know, like when you start seeing the hell of war because you were in it, you start being like, you know what? Can we have our own say? I mean, Canada got the same thing with when we were sent to our slaughter. Especially in the Second World War, though, with the Battle of Dieppe, that was a breaking point. Be like, Britain, you know what? You can't lead us to war no more. You're a fuckface.
Go home, Britain.
Go home. You're drunk, you bitch. So, anyways, I guess that's my, like, you know, if you want my complete analysis, I could go on for fucking hours, but I won't. I mean, what I wanted to talk about is on a Remembrance Day. What we should probably think a lot about is the fact that the issues that make wars happen, I mean, they can happen for a number of reasons. And some of them, just when you look back at it, you're like, that seems like a stupid reason. Like if you could have told everybody that was about to sign up to war that the stupid propaganda that was being blasted, like, join up now, lads, and experience the adventure of war. You know, like you could have saved a lot of fucking people by being honest about that shit, by showing it for what it really was, which was just hell. Like the testimonies of people that were there and came back, like, you didn't come back normal, all right? Like some of those stories, like the story that stuck with me when I was a kid was one soldier who said that the only way to deal with all of these dead bodies in the trenches that you couldn't bury and they were constantly fucking staring at you and were slowly sinking into the ground like quicksand was to play jokes, was to have fun with it. So like if a hand was like sticking out from the mud, you'd like shake and be like, good day, sir, and try to get everyone to laugh. Because it was the only thing that could make you feel human again. The only thing. Playing with cadavers, because that's the fucking best thing you can do.
Oh, man.
Happy Remembrance Day, everybody.
Tapping into our darkest, darkest lizard brain.
Wear a poppy, and then you'll do your part like anybody fucking remembers. And you know what? The people who mostly wear that, it's to glorify the military most of the time. It's to say, good job killing. And you're just like, I don't know about that.
I think many people, at least our age, I suppose, had a grandfather or a great-grandfather. And it was more like out of respect, you know, whatever that means when you tell a child, do something out of respect.
Yeah.
Right. But
it would be better if they kind of understood the very.
But maybe nature. It's like, what else are you going to do? Like, there are so many people died and so many families were affected that. Now you're back to normal life, and you can't just forget that horror. Sure, a little poppy on your lapel is just a symbol, but what else can you do?
No, I know. I think that once a year, you should just see some fucking footage of the trenches.
You know what?
Just watch that shit. Maybe see what human beings do to each other.
Maybe it is worth, you know, upping the shock value a little bit.
Maybe,
you know,
a little.
Scaring people, because go a few generations where there isn't a major war or a draft or something, and yeah, people will forget.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be more willing to wage a new one.
And they'll probably romanticize it. So
yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, maybe scare the living shit out of people.
Right.
Just a little bit. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. Look, You know why Halloween exists, and or some other form of Festival of the Dead exists in almost every culture? We do it because we have to deal with death, and we find that the best way to do it is to kind of be jovial about it. Well, this is not the way to deal with the other reality of life, which is fucking war, okay? And if you're just going to ignore it because you think people are so good, they'll never go to war again, wake the fuck up. There are multiple wars happening right now. America has currently been at war for the longest time it's ever been. What is it, like 15 fucking years you've been at war with at least one country, if not like multiple? Like, you have never stopped being at war since the Second World War. Like, it was one or another, like deposing one country, fucking like bombing Cambodia, Korea, Vietnam. Like, do you have to really go through the whole list? I mean, there's a lot, okay? The first Gulf War, the second Gulf War, Jesus Christ, it never ends. Like, are Americans just tired of that? It's like, do you ever wake up in the morning and be like, man, I wish we didn't have to go to war today? Like, it would be so great if I didn't have to watch those videos of soldiers coming home and hugging their kids because they thought that their daddy would never come back home. Jesus Christ, those videos are hard to watch.
My God.
I know, right? Anyways, so on those days, maybe it's really important that we actually work hard to not glorify war. Which brings me to our second topic, bro, which is my review of Battlefield 1.
Battlefield 1.
A World War 1 multiplayer shooter that is so fun and glorifies war like nobody's business. Well, okay. That's not my necessarily review, and I have to be a little bit more nuanced than that. But for the most part, yeah, every time you have a war game, you're basically glorifying war. I mean, it's just real fun when you're playing these games, right? It's a lot of fun.
Well, do you think it's sort of innate, like, you know, young boys or whatever like to...
Like conflict?
Yeah, like conflict and fighting and stuff.
I think...
And
I'm
stereotyping. I know there's girls who are like that.
Oh, yeah. But I think for the most part, that comes from people's natural need to...
But do you think it's, you
have
think
a
it's
contest
built in?
Or stuff,
you think
a
contest. Bit of nurture, too?
No, I think it's mostly built in.
Yeah.
I think that even if you had the most... Look, what I'm saying is that you can contrast like the most tolerant societies versus the least ones, and you'll find almost exactly the same behavior at core when you're dealing with specific age groups. I think you're right that when you get to a certain age, I think you can be more influenced by things like culture, forced politeness, you know, like the kind of shit you have to learn when you're working at a job. Like, you don't whip your dick out at a job, do you? You learn a few things.
Depends on the job.
But when you're a kid, when you're a little kid running around, you whip out your dick all the time, okay? That's what little kids do.
Little boys
in the age group of about 3 to 4 cannot stop fucking whipping their dicks out, buddy.
Right.
This is just a phenomenon. So some of us learn to stop doing that. A few don't. But you know, like, I think that what most
Step
people don't
three
realize
profit.
Is that they're always saying like, we need to educate the young to be more polite. You can't, stupid little brains can't do it. You have to do that with adults. You got to do that to 30-year-olds. Teach them manners. You know?
Yeah.
Teach them fucking be like, hey, you know what? You let that old person get on the bus first, you little asshole. You're not that much in a hurry. They're in pain. Stop being so
and
selfish.
It's a bus. You're going to arrive at the same time. Hello.
It's the simple things. Like I said in the last show, the really simple things. But
Battlefield 1.
Battlefield 1 is... Here's a video game that basically puts a gun in your hand and has you play with a bunch of your friends to go shoot other people in recreated battles of World War One. So, you know, you can play as the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you can play as the Ottoman Empire, you know, all the kind of empires that went down.
The Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Whatever, dude.
The first spacefaring empire.
like the boys.
They were so fucking rad. Steam-powered ships.
They were so advanced. Why didn't they make it?
Right.
Why did they collapse?
Am I right?
Yeah. But so the game is the game came out, I think, October 23rd, and it was kind of like one of those surprise games because I don't know if you've noticed recently, but a lot of games have been about the future. We kind of have a bit of an obsession with the future, right? Like outer space, everybody wants to go to Mars and shit. It's part of our psyche. They're like, oh my God, we're ruining the planet. Let's go somewhere else. Yeah. Why don't you fix your problems here? Instead of fucking running off to a desert planet with no fucking magnetosphere. Yeah, smart move there, buddy. But anyways, it's just, there was apparently discussion at Electronic Arts one day about like, well, hey, what kind of a new Battlefield should we do? And one guy just jokingly said, hey, let's do World War One. And at first, like, the big boss man was like, ah, I don't think that's a good idea. That's not where the market's going, and it would be a huge risk. But a couple of people inside EA said, you know what, let's make a fucking test level. And so they designed, which was what is basically the first level of the game, where you play as one of these Harlem Hellfighters, and you're trying to repel a wave of German fighters. And one of the really interesting things about the game is when you get shot and killed, your perspective suddenly switches to another soldier. So after you see the soldier's name and their death, which are actually real people who died during those times, it switches you to another perspective as you continue to fight during that first level. And when they saw the level, like, first of all, everybody fell in love with it. But there was also something really interesting about the idea, because when you play most first-person shooters and you die, death is very insignificant in most games. It's meaningless. Like, you just like, oh, right, I'll just press the continue button. Like, who cares about death?
Reset.
But as a organic being that has a very, very vested interest in its life, death is a pretty fucking big deal. So I think it's interesting to be put in a perspective in which, you know, you can at least internalize what's going on, right? You're not just, oh, I resurrected. Okay, that guy died. And there's almost a feeling of guilt when you let that person... You know, you missed that shot where the guy was trying to, like, kill you, and you're like, oh, man, you missed that shot, and you would have been killed too. And I guess when you're playing the game in general, seeing the chaos that unfolds around you as mortar shells go off, giant tanks are taken out, people in cavalry, because they were still using horses and cavalry during that time too, for fuck's sakes. When you see all of this chaos and battle and just watching people fall left, right, and center, there is a thought that enters your mind, which is like, I don't want to be here in the real world. Like, this, I would survive exactly 2 seconds out in this fucking madhouse.
So the realism is what sort of hooked people? The fact that death mattered, and, well, it was more warlike?
I think that what really ultimately appealed to people is, I think that people kind of have a natural curiosity to it, but World War One has never been shown to people in a very sexy way. We're shown World War II all the time because it had a sexy, like, villain, right? It had Hitler as a villain, and you can, or Mussolini as a villain. You know, you could think of these people. They have a spot in your head. It's more marketable. But during the First World War, I mean, the real enemy was imperialism. That doesn't have a fucking face, right? Like, how are you supposed to identify that? And the First World War solved nothing. It just created the problems that eventually led to the Second World War. And did the Second World War really solve that many things, or did it just create a different fucking problem, right? So, I mean, I guess what's important about seeing this history is knowing what exactly unfolded. And the biggest and most important thing that happened post-war, or as a consequence of these wars, because after the First World War ended, well, or even slightly before that, a whole bunch of countries were so fucked that their systems of government changed entirely. All right, they went, yeah. For instance, Russia had a civil war right after the war because basically everybody was starving. The Tsar, which was an incompetent fool, was murdered, and all the oligarchs were being chased for fucking the ends of the earth, and they took all of the gold with them, which has also never been found. So imagine your country's now broke, you have no fucking gold reserves, and you're in civil war that's basically killing about 10 to 15 million people when you've already suffered, like, I don't know, a few million casualties already.
Did you say the gold was never found?
That is correct. $80 billion worth of gold. The lost treasure of the Tsar, you can look this up if you don't fucking believe me, has never been located. So Russia's secret gold. I mean, you ever wonder why is Russia so broke? Well, the rich oligarchs thought that if they could hide the gold, keep it away from the communists, they'd take their country back, and then they'd rebuild it with the gold. And it appears as though everybody who hid that gold died. So, anyways, which is why I've invented a little story. One day you'll find out what that story is about. But yes, I love the little bits of history like that where you can just make a sexy, like Indiana Jones like story around something like that, right? But say, hey, Indiana Jones can be interesting if it's, you know, in the First World War. Fuck, like I said, the First World War is a lot more interesting than you possibly think. Like a good example of just a quirky little fact is that the most multicultural place in the planet during the First World War and was in Belgium. It was a military town that was just kind of to supply and build the majority of British tanks, which were built by Chinese people. And the British had hired like hundreds of thousands of Chinese to fucking build their tanks and do all kinds of labor that the soldiers didn't want. I mean, they didn't just hire Chinese. They hired all kinds of different groups. And suddenly these people were living in a town that had previously had like maybe 8,000 inhabitants, and suddenly there was 100,000 of people that were from different cultures. I mean, suddenly the people of that town were a minority, and they found out a lot of interesting things about cultures that at that time were the most alien things in the world. I mean, remember, you didn't have fucking TV or whatever, and you see an Indian person for the first time, and like apparently, I mean, they were all friendly, but they would look through windows inside people's houses because they were curious too. They'd never seen how white people lived and shit. I mean, that's how it was back then. I mean, all the horrors of war, sure, but it also kind of opened up a lot of fucking eyeballs about the rest of the world suddenly when they were all smashed together just in one fucking little odd, violent time frame.
World's worst meetup.
What was really hilarious, too, is at the beginning, the Chinese people thought this war was hilarious. Every time mortars would go off at first, they were all clapping and laughing. They didn't know what the fuck was going on. They were just hired to do some work. Like, they're in China, they're like, oh, they need laborers. They didn't know it was World War One. They didn't realize, like, oh, yeah, those mortars could kill you. And after a few deaths, they were a lot less jovial. But that's the weirdness of it all, dude. I don't think the weirdness has really even kind of finally set into people about, like, a whole world went to war. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of fucked up, right, when you think about it?
It's a bit fucked up.
That's really fucked up. And then they dragged the world in it again, like, just a decade and a half later, like, Or 2 decades later. So I mean, that's just messed. Imagine only a 20-year reprieve from like the worst conflict you've ever experienced in your life, followed by a horrible plague that killed as many people as the war killed. Like 1 in 10 of like most of the people. Like you would know at least 2 people, 2 of your friends would fucking die. Like boom, just like that.
You like war? Well, here's a plague.
Why do you think the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse are the consequence of war, right? You have famine, pestilence, is it disease? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, yes, you have famine. I mean, and that's one of the things, too. When soldiers were talking about their experiences during the war, they couldn't believe how much devastation they were leaving behind. They were burning down farms and things like that. They were like, we are leaving behind death. When we are gone from here, people will die because of what we've done. Fuck.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah. So, well, like, can we not fight each other
anymore? I hate to bring it back to modern times, but like,
why
war is still really shitty.
War would be worse.
It's just World War One, and now is like distant enough that I guess we sort of have to rediscover it.
It's more than 100 years, dude.
Right?
More than 100 years. And I mean, I hope that most people who are playing Battlefield 1, because like I said, it's a hell of a fun game and I'm having a great time with it. I hope they don't seem to glorify too much, but here's the bad news. So my experience so far playing it has made me realize that a lot of people, because one of the options you have in Battlefield 1 is you can make your own little image for your own badge. And the amount of Nazi symbols, KKK hoods, and that kind of shit that I've seen right now...
Oh, man.
Is unacceptable.
It's on the rise.
It is on the rise. You know, you thought it was funny when I was writing that script, remember, Under Fire, where I was going to tell a story about this soldier who comes back home and his town's been overrun by a bunch of KKK dudes, and you're like, I think everybody looked at me and be like, that's not really believable. It's very believable.
Prescient.
I mean, just on a side note, when after Obama was elected, membership to the Ku Klux Klan went up by 300%. Just to keep, and that was then. I don't know how much it went up when Donald Trump was elected, but it's probably pretty high. All right, well, with that, my number is 14.
And my number is B.
That's not a number. Actually, in math, it's probably a number. Is B a number in math?
It is.
There you go. I knew it. All right, go fuck yourselves, everybody.